Chapter 6, December 3rd. Wanted. Martin drove hard, ignoring the thudding of his tires and the screech of harvest stubble scraping the sides of his truck. In the east, dawn burned orange, so he didn't have much time before the lights of followers would become invisible and he'd lose his chance to catch up, maybe forever. Last night, he'd driven out to his house to be in their path, but hadn't been able to find his family. Wanderers had gone past, but there had been so many of them, far more than he'd realized, and his family had escaped him. He consulted his compass. He was no navigator, but was trying to drive as straight in a north-northwesterly direction as he could. Wanderers went in straight lines, so people said. At first, he'd tried to reason with Lindy. He had picked up Winnie and carried her to the car, and been bitten for his trouble. He had not been able to find Trevor at all, which had only added to his sorrow. All around him, there had been screaming people, begging their loved ones not to go, trying to wake them up. They'd gone off down Third Street and between two boarded-up stores. Behind those stores was Oak Street, then behind it Leonard Lane, then the Plains, and 10 miles out the Smokes, and beyond them the High Plains, then Canada. And somewhere, he felt sure, whatever fate was in store for them. Martin had trotted over to his jeep and got in, and then Bobby was there. "Hey, guy, we need to do this another way." Martin had looked at him, and it was like looking across a great black river to a man whose life was unfolding on a better shore. He fought the tears down, but when his friend reached in and put a hand on his shoulder, he broke down. Bobby stayed with him until there were screams, then shots off in the direction of Oak Street. A follower was killing a wanderer, probably based on an agreement. It was a common thing these days, not considered murder. "Gotta go," Bobby said. "You stay right here. You're coming home with us." Martin had waited for a couple of minutes, but then he had turned on his car and moved off toward Leonard Lane. He had seen, out in the fallow fields, a slowly moving cluster of lights disappearing into the night. There were voices, too, cries and pleas echoing in the silence, and then a voice, high and full of something Martin guessed must be faith. "Yea, though we walk through the valley of the shadow of death," then lost to an errant wind and long thunder out of the west. Martin had not returned to Third Street Methodist. He had not been able to face going home with the Chalmers family. Instead, he had driven out into the night, going up 1540 into the Smokes. He knew every inch of the hills where he lived. As a boy, he'd hunted the Smokes with his dad, taking white-tailed deer and turkey. He'd hunted across the very land where he'd built his house. Nowadays, he didn't hunt, largely because Trevor wasn't interested. He preferred the intricacies of fishing. And just Saturday before last, they'd driven over to the Kaw River and fished for cats, with cut shad, and done well. Except, of course, Lindy and Winnie had thought them insane to use shad as bait in order to eat catfish, but they were women, and... oh, hell. He'd had to pull over. He was just plain overcome. By the time he'd gotten home, he'd known that he was in serious shock. He needed medical attention. But Willerson was the only doctor in town, and hadn't he gone out with the wanderers? Martin had taken a couple of the Xanax he used to mainline during bill-paying time. He'd wandered his own home like a ghost, pacing from room to room, hugging Winnie's beloved stuffed elephant she had named Bearish, and burying his face in Trevor's pillow. He had ended up in his own bed, clutching one of Lindy's nightgowns to his face, and had stayed there until the sun was well up. There had come a buzz from the front door. It was rosy with food, the sort of casserole you brought to the bereaved. "Harrow's formed a committee," she had said. "Followers, you're welcome to join. They're going to be taking food and water. Some plan on going all the way. Do we still know where they are? Helen's out there with a walkie-talkie. They're about 12 miles out, moving at 3 miles an hour. North-northwest, just like all the rest. They're about 1 mile from Holcomb's Wanderers, and it looks like the two groups are going to meet up about noon. That'll put it up to about 2,000 people. 2,000? Hun, there's just 18 intact families in Harrow. None in Holcomb. In fact, Bobby drove over there, and he's telling us the place is entirely empty. Then she added, "We also lost some kids. Children of folks who got hit. The little ones stayed around, but a lot of the older kids, 15 to 20 or so, we can't find them. They aren't wandering, and they aren't here anymore." Another unknown was a cold, frightening thought. Rosie had helped him pile the jeep with every bit of everything edible and drinkable in the house. A six-pack of Dr. Pepper, 2 bunches of celery, beer, milk, half and half, orange and cranapple juice, Winnie's soy milk, all the cereal, the lean cuisines, everything it could find, even unbaked refrigerator cookies. And seeing the Pillsbury Doughboy on a half-used tube of cookies had brought more tears, angry tears. He had driven out just after noon, going down 205 to the Holcomb crossroads and then out into the fields. He'd crisscrossed the countryside for hours, finding not a sign of anybody. Increasingly afraid and frustrated, he'd driven harder and harder, bounding through fields, screaming around bends, and in all that time not come upon a single human being, wanderer, follower, or free. Now he was here, sitting on a bare quarter of a tank of gas with the sun going down. He realized that he was at Dennis Farm, one of the places that had been hit before the strike on Harrow. Well, he knew the Dennises, and he decided that he could go ahead and borrow some of their tractor gas. He drove the jeep over to the pump and tried to turn it on. No good. He went around the side of the barn and fired up the generator, then returned and filled his tank. He looked across at the dark house, and after he'd cut off the pump and the generator, got in the jeep to continue his quest. He thought he heard something, though, and went over to the house. He approached it warily, not sure what to expect. The Dennises had raised about 10 kids, but they were all gone, doctors and lawyers and corporate executives and other things that were not farmers. He heard it again, a sort of mechanical chuckling sound. Was it coming from inside? He couldn't be sure. Could be around the side of the house. "Hello? Anybody there?" No response. Then the sound returned, more distinct this time, and he realized that it was coming from 2 directions, out behind the low hill that separated the house from their north fields, and then again from down near the pretty little stream that was one of the reasons they'd put the house here. For all the world, it sounded like 2 dirty old men chuckling at him over his plight. "Hello?" Then he heard something in the sky. Whoosh! Whoosh! He looked up, but clouds were coming in, and it had turned inky black. His mouth went dry. His heart began the peculiar twisting beat that came when his fear increased. He ran to his car and jumped in and locked the doors. Who knew what might be out there? Aliens, even the concealed architects. What was it some old scientist had said? Aliens, when they come, will be stranger than anything we have ever imagined or can possibly imagine. Words to that effect. Beings from a parallel universe might be even stranger, or strangely similar. He got out of there fast, driving as close to northwest as he could, blasting his way through the stubble-choked, furrowed fields. How very ordinary it had all seemed just a month ago, driving out this way to pick out a Thanksgiving turkey at Smeal's. He had seen old man Dennis working his harvest, thought how sad it was that out of all those kids he couldn't find a single one willing to continue the tradition. Word was they were going to sell out and move to Florida, but he'd thought at the time, no, the Dennises are going to die on that land. The sun slid behind the clouds, and with night came an increase of loneliness that was so deep it amounted to a new kind of emotion for him. He drove on, searching blindly, trying his best to stay on course. It was some moments after he'd seen the glow on the horizon that he realized that it meant headlights in the distance. He stopped the jeep, got out, and clambered up on the roof. About 2 miles ahead, there was a slowly moving cluster of lights, the cars and trucks of followers. Couldn't be from Holcomb. They had all been disensouled. So that had to be the Harrow contingent. Lindy was out there somewhere, his Lindy and his Winnie, and maybe Trevor. He looked up into the black sky and wondered if those were dead bodies out there, and if his family's souls had gone somewhere better. Oh, God, please help them. Help me help them, God. If only you're there. We need you. We need you. He got down and drove ahead, keeping his own lights off so he could see the caravan. He closed quickly. They weren't going fast, obviously. Soon he was in among them, about 5 vehicles. It had been more. The wanderers had lost many followers. "Hey, bone collector," a woman's voice yelled. "Helen?" She leaned out the back of the Turpin's mangled Buick. "Got supplies?"
"I got 'em."
"My Reg likes Oreos. You got Oreos?"
"I've got some Pillsbury chocolate chip cookie mix."
"Well, hell, I'll try it on him. I think he sort of recognized John 24, by the way, so I'm looking for a comeback."
"You folks seen Lindy?"
another voice called.
"Sure thing, Martin. We fed your family twice. Your girl's happy when she gets soy milk."
That was right. Oh, God, that was Winnie's favorite. He scoured the backs that were visible in the car lights, but there were so many of them. It wasn't a small crowd. It was enormous. It stretched on and on. He stopped and got out. He grabbed soy milk and orange juice. They would need strength and fluids. They would be in shock, and they'd been walking continuously now for close to 20 hours.
"Be careful there,"
a voice said as he sprinted among the vehicles, then out into the darker crowd of wanderers.
"Winnie," he called. "Soy milk, soy milk. Trevor Winters, Dad's here. Dad's got cranapple."
Then he saw a back, familiar hair. He doubled his speed, pushing past people who were breathing hard, who were staggering. What was going to happen? Would they be walked to death? Why not kill them outright and save everybody this terrible, terrible suffering?
"Lindy! Lindy!"
A head turned, and he found himself looking into the empty grin of Beryl Walsh, the local bank manager. He went on.
"Lindy! Trevor! Winnie!"
There was her hair again, and this time he was sure.
"Oh, Lindy, hey, hey, it's me, babes. I'm going to take you home. I've got the truck. I'm going to take you guys home."
He came up beside her, and it was definitely Lindy of the green eyes and the straight, proud nose, Lindy of the bobbing blonde hair.
"Oh, baby, I got you. Thank the Lord." He looked around.
"Where are the kids?"
"Winnie?
Where's Winnie?" Not a glance, not a word. He sprinted in front of her, walked backward as he talked.
"The kids, Lindy. Where are the kids?"
She came straight on, her face expressionless. Unlike some of them, she didn't even have a smile left in her. She strode like a Valkyrie, though, a powerful, healthy woman whom he thought was going to make an excellent slave. Would they be taken to another world? Like the slavers took people from Africa.
How similar that must have felt to this, to the people who watched the ship sail away. It had been history to him before, but those millions of lost families were now part of his heart. And he thought, the Nephilim, those strange rapists mentioned in Genesis, called the Fallen Ones, they had enslaved us before biblical times, had they not? Enslaved us, and then gone, mysteriously. In recent years, as his data piled up, he had become more and more willing to entertain the notion that there might have been some sort of human-alien interaction in the distant past, which had led to the catastrophe of 12,000 BC, when the makers of the great stone monuments had abruptly vanished. Had it been a war? Had it been, perhaps, something like this? And therefore, were these people going to some far place, destined to suffer a fate that maybe not even God could know? Then, a miracle. He saw Winnie. She was trundling along. She had a bit of a limp. He ran to her, swept her up in his arms, cried out, buried his face in her little girl sweetness, and then realized that her legs were still moving. She was still walking, in fact. She hadn't stopped walking even when she was picked up. Pointing her back toward the car, he put her down. She took a few steps. Then, as if she was controlled by some sort of inner gyroscope, she turned abruptly and continued on with the others. He hurried along beside her. "I've got some soy milk for you, honey," he said. He fumbled in his pocket for a box of it and held it out to her. She took it and drank it down. "Thank you, baby," he found himself saying. "Thank you." Then he cried out, "Trevor! Trevor Winters! Dad's here! I've got cranapple! Dad has cranapple!" His throat constricted and he had to stop. He controlled his emotions, fought them back, and kept on. "Trevor Winters! Trevor Winters!" He moved back and forth in the crowd, and suddenly there was a light in his eyes. "Martin, hey, buddy." "You're George Matthews. I'm that damn plumber." "Oh, George, for the love of... yeah." "You're looking for Trevor?" "Yeah, actually, I got Winnie to drink some soy milk." "That ain't Winnie anymore. And Trevor's not here."
"Not here?"
"Nah. Trevor's not wandering." He grabbed the man's shoulder. "George, George, are you sure?" "There's something else going on. There's kids gone." Are they okay, George?" He could feel George's eyes on him. "Dunno, but my girl's one of them. Wife's out here."
"And you're sure they're not...
Trevor is definitely not here? You're certain of it?"
"Not certain of anything in this world, bro. But I've been out here all day with my Molly, and I've seen Winnie and Lindy plenty, but not him. And I did see him, you know, after the church. And he was going out toward the smokes with my daughter and some of the middle schoolers. He wasn't wandering, Martin."
Martin turned around with the intention of going back to the house immediately. And it was then that he saw the thick column of light drop down like some kind of bright shroud on the cars of the followers.
"Oh, my God," he said.
George turned too and saw it.
"God Almighty!"
He began to run, loping ahead to the wanderers who continued on at their steady and oblivious pace. Martin's first impulse was to follow him. But a golden shaft came down, razor-thin and quick, and George sparkled for a moment, and then dropped back, joining his pace to that of the other wanderers. It had been that quick. Martin forced himself not to run. He forced himself to fall in with the wanderers, to pretend to be one of them. As he had on many a hike, he walked beside his wife. The screaming behind him told him that the light was doing all the followers. Their compassion and their love had been used to trap them. Then he saw little Winnie fall and cry out, and his whole heart and soul longed to help his child, but he kept on walking.
The wanderers never slowed their pace, but every so often he saw one or another of them fall down. The others simply walked over them. It was a brutal and brutally efficient selection process, he thought. Only the strong would make it, and only the strong, obviously, would be wanted. Overhead, he once again heard the whoosh, whoosh of something. Could it be that a big old barn owl was shadowing them? But the owl's wing is silent. Ahead and to his left, there was leaping movement. A voice rose in a frantic salad of words, babbling and shrieking, then going silent. He looked neither left nor right, but kept on, leaving the struggle behind him. Soon the voice was silent, replaced by that odd mechanical chuckling he'd heard in the woods around his house. Eventually the sounds faded. He was aware that Lindy was just beyond his touch, and that Winnie maybe had fallen aside. He forgot all his careful intellectualizations about God and prayed the Jesus prayer over and over again, the prayer out of J.D. Salinger's Franny and Zoe, which had been a favorite of Lindy's. It was the repetitive prayer from The Way of the Pilgrim, "Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me, a sinner." As the stars wheeled in their generous majesty, Martin walked to the rhythm set by repetitions. From time to time, the light dropped down on another follower it had discovered in the mass of wanderers and ripped out a soul. The rhythm made it easier for him, but by the time 2 hours had passed, he knew that he could not keep up with the pace of the wanderers much longer. He was contemplating this danger, letting the prayer drop into the back of his mind, when he heard a distant voice. It had an echoing, mechanical quality to it. He listened, and then incredibly saw its source. A police car stood on a roadside ahead, its light bar flashing. Beside it stood a state policeman with an electronic bullhorn. He raised it to his lips and blared, "You are trespassing on a wildlife preservation zone. You are required to leave this area immediately. Please come up to the roadway, ladies and gentlemen. You are trespassing." A tongue of light snicked down out of the clouds, and there appeared around him the loveliest spreading glitter of little stars that Martin had ever seen. From this distance, you could see exactly how the light made the soul literally burst out of the body. He thought that a human soul was truly a universe all its own, as the stars that had been that man's memories, dreams, and hopes flittered into oblivion. The trooper dropped his bullhorn and turned northwest. Martin had reached a point of crisis. He had to stop. No choice. Already he was visibly dropping back. He couldn't help it. "Goodbye, Lindy," he said in his heart. "Goodbye, my love, and goodbye, Lindy's soul, wherever you are, and God rest you, my baby Winnie. My poor little girl never even had a life." Then he let himself fall forward like an exhausted wanderer. He did not close his eyes, but rather continued staring straight down at the ground. Soon, the last of the wanderers had passed him by. He heard the intimate whistle of a nightbird, then something else, that chuckling again. It was close, and there was a lot of it. Now he thought it was like a flock of geese in flight, honking back and forth to one another as they plowed the sky. The aliens. That must be it. This sound represented the elusive aliens coming along behind their human herd, drovers, cowboys. Then something stepped on his back. It was heavy, and it had a sharpness that penetrated his jeans and entered his thigh. He had to force himself not to move as this sharpness very painfully twisted inside his flaring muscle. Then it was gone, and he could just glimpse what looked like the leg of an insect touching the ground beside his face, then another.
And then the chuckling had gone on ahead, and with it the faint whooshing and whistling in the sky. Then he knew that there was light all around him. He felt the most incredible rage at his defeat, and then waited to feel the light, to know what it was like to lose your soul. Did you go with it, or stay in your body, or, as he thought, just disappear? But then there was something in his ear, snuffling, and an odor, a familiar one. He opened his eyes, turned his head, and found himself face to face with a very large skunk. As the tail rose, he rolled, then jumped up and ran like hell, and the skunk ran too, wobbling off into the light, which was not the light of death, but that of dawn. He stood up in the sunlight. It was golden, low still on the horizon, but so pure that it must be as sacred as the old Egyptians had thought, and he turned toward it and knelt as he might to God. Then he went back along the long series of low folds in the land, heading toward his truck, hoping to find Winnie's body somewhere, a little snatch of clothes somewhere in the prairie. But he found an adult instead, blood-soaked, dead. This was no fallen wanderer. This person had been done violence. He looked down. The school jacket, the smoothness of the backs of the hands. This was just a kid. He turned him over and leaped back when he realized what he was seeing, and when he fully realized it, screamed. Instantly, he stifled it. The light did not come during the day, apparently being rendered ineffective by the sun, but there had been other things out there, and he wasn't so sure that they were particularly nocturnal. He thought that this pitiful ruin must have been a boy. He was at most 15 or 16, and he had been horrifically mutilated. His lips were gone, his mouth open, and his tongue removed. His eyes had been gouged out, and his lower body was bloody. Martin didn't examine him too closely, but it looked as if he had been castrated, too. He forced himself to open the shirt, to look for the familiar mole that would mean he had found his son. The cool gray skin was unblemished. Martin stood up and ran a short distance, then came back and picked the poor kid up and carried him in his arms. He carried him across a field and into an empty farmyard and put him down in a porch swing. "Hey, anybody home? Hey!" Not a sound. He went inside and found eggs in the fridge and cracked 6 of them, raw, into his mouth. He also ate cheese and crunched into a head of lettuce. He drank warm grapefruit juice that nearly made him puke. Then he went on, walking until the sun was high and warm, and the gladness that it brings even to the most oppressed human heart made him close his eyes and lift his face to it. "Lucky old son," he said. Whereupon he found his truck, which he had left running. He jumped in and pulled the key out. He'd damn well burned out all his gas. Damned fool that he was. Fool! Well, not quite all. There was a hairline between the edge of the gauge and the red line, so there was still a mile or so in it. He walked back to the farm. But this was a hobby place. There was no gas tank here. Returning to the Jeep, he got in and started it. He headed back toward Harrow, and had the town in sight when he ran out of gas. He never passed Dennis Farm, but he'd been looking for it. Never saw a trace of it. Must have been too far east of it, he figured. He walked for half an hour, finally crossing the last field and climbing a final fence. Then he was in a backyard. He went down the driveway beside the house and into the dead empty streets. A flicker of curtain in this house or that was the only indication of life here. He was passing the bank when a familiar car pulled alongside him. "Bobby!" Bobby just looked up at him. His eyes were strange, and for a moment Martin had a horrible thought.
Bobby?
Yeah?
Your family okay?
He stopped his car. Jesus, his family had gotten it in the night.
Oh, buddy, did you lose him?
He shook his head.
Bobby, what's the matter?
He held out a flyer. Martin took it. He was astonished to find himself staring at his own face.
This man is wanted dead. Name, Martin Trevor Winters. Last seen in the area of Lautner County, Kansas. This man is extremely dangerous and carries a bounty of $10 million upon satisfactory proof of death being provided.
Martin looked at Bobby, met his eyes, saw them flicker away. His face said it clearly. This was not a joke.
Homeland Security dropped them off about half an hour ago.
But I... There must be some mistake.
Buddy, you know I love you. But I got this job here and half the town. They are looking for your blood.
But what did I do? Why has this happened?
It doesn't say what you did, but we all know you were over there in Egypt when the pyramid went, and it must have something to do with that, which is why I'm arresting you, buddy.
Bobby?
I'm not going to read you your rights, because it's a patriot arrest. You don't have any rights.
Bobby, hey!
But Bobby cuffed him and took him off to the sheriff's substation and put him in the one cell which had been cleaned of file boxes for the occasion. He drove through town telling them that Martin had been caught and they had to meet at First Christ to vote on what to do with him. Chapter 7. December 4th. The Trap. Wiley stared at the words on his computer screen. This damn nightmare was way out of control. He'd come back from the shrink, determined to just erase the whole thing, but he hadn't done it. And now look what had happened. It had gotten so much worse, so fast. Winnie was probably dead, and Trevor, God knew what had happened to him, and look at poor Martin. He was going to be killed by his friends. But it wasn't only what was happening to this one little family. It was the whole vast scope of the thing, an entire world being destroyed. That bastard Samson was part of it. Al North was right. He was a traitor. But the fool hadn't shot him, stupid fool. Nice guy sure as hell finish last, General North. Wiley had CNN on continuously now, waiting for any sign of anything odd happening at any sacred site in his own world. So far, this dear old place was quiet. But would it be forever? They knew we were here, or we wouldn't see UFOs. They just needed one more little push, he suspected, and they'd be in. Let NASA announce that UFOs were real. Let the Air Force admit that it couldn't explain some sighting or other, and bang! Here come the lenses, dark goddamn things blowing the same 14 sacred sites to hell here as they did in the Two Moon world. When he wasn't writing, he did research and he thought. He thought about the number 14. It was the Osiris number, the Jesus number, the resurrection number. 7 was a complete octave and a complete life. 14 was a life and a life beyond. It was the number of the goal of man, which was the projection of human consciousness into eternity. Osiris had been cut into 14 pieces. The Passion of Christ had 14 stations. Destroy the man, build the man. Might that be true also of whole worlds? He sighed, blew air out. Was he tired? He was beyond tired, more exhausted than he'd thought it was possible to be. He did not think he could imagine what the suffering going on Martin's world was like. By now, every single human being on the planet who was not himself a wanderer had lost at least one loved one. The sheer scale of it was beyond imagination, appalling. What could he write about it?
that had brought tears to his eyes, made his mouth dry, made his stomach fill with fire. Describing this was beyond even a great novelist's skill, and certainly beyond his. 14. He kept going back to it. The 14 sacred places were there to enable us to recover the knowledge that made man immortal. Giza, Tassili, Ollantaytambo, all the way around to Easter Island, Sukhothai, Persepolis, and Petra, to enable us to recover the knowledge and also to protect us from our ignorance. In Martin's world, they had failed. Too late, just. He had been close, but not close enough, not in time. That was why Samson was after him. The knowledge he possessed was still dangerous. It was evening now on this earth, on Martin's earth, presumably, on all the earths and all the universes that filled the unimaginable firmament, including the world of the reptilians. He'd never seen it. Glimpsed it, perhaps, down in the draw that night, felt the delicate hands of the monsters, felt them raping him. He thought he knew why it had been done. They needed a communicator to spread belief in them. Problem was, they chose the wrong guy. They needed a Nobel Prize winner or a great political leader, not a horror novelist. Too bad, suckers. Voices, shrill with excitement, reassured him that all was still well. At least in his neck of the woods. Nick and Kelsey were playing normally outside. Brooke was downstairs making one of her stunning pot roasts. The kids sounded very happy together, and that was not always the case. Even though she was 8 and he 13, there was still plenty of sibling rivalry to cut through. In another year, Nick probably wouldn't be willing to run around like that with his little sister. But he was having old-fashioned childhood fun now, oblivious for once to the fact that he would soon, at 13, no longer be a child. It was a dark afternoon, with some heavy fall weather on its way in from the northwest. Typical Kansas. A little late for the season was all. He glanced at his weather radio. The light glowed green, meaning that it was on and hadn't picked up any alerts. Still, blue flickering came from the sky, and thunder rolled in from far away. The storms were still the other side of Holcomb, maybe 50 miles out. Probably they'd arrive during the night. He didn't like storms. He feared that the disks might come, might be hiding in them. But no. The lenses were the anchors, hooks in the gills of the fish, as it were. And there were no lenses here. He kept telling himself that. Then he would think, what if there were just one or two? Tassili was in the middle of the desert. Nazca was isolated. So were a number of the other sites. Most of them. They had been created so long ago that they were all centered on a North Pole from God only knew how far back in the past. He wanted a drink so badly that he dared not open the liquor drawer. No way. He stared at his words on the screen. Lindy and Winnie destroyed, Trevor gone, Martin about to be locked up, which he could still see taking place. Even though he had stopped writing, the story still unfolded in the bright hell of his mind. In it, Martin was watching his old friend lock the cell door, and Bobby had tears in his eyes as he did it. No, this was too much. This had to go, and now was the time. He selected the chapter and erased it. And wow, there were some blood, sweat, and tears down the drain. So, okay, that was done, and it should be done. He'd rewrite it with a more bearable scenario. The blank page confronted him, and he told himself that he actually preferred blank pages. Bullshit. This was awful, killing his work like this. But he had to. He could not see his people suffer this much. So he started a new chapter. Then he stopped. He didn't feel like just plunging into it like this, and he was sick of using the laptop, which he closed.
Writing on the computer was an addiction, and he already had too damn many of those, drinking the way he did and sneaking cigars and wanting to do a lot more than that. He put his beloved old Corona back in her place of honor. Now, this was a writer's tool. She clattered like an old freight train, churning out the words, engraving every mistake in stone. Everything he had done, everything real, had been done on this fine old typewriter. Early days, he would lie in bed writing through the night on yellow pads, then transcribe them onto her in the morning. Civilized way to work. As he rolled in a sheet of paper, he noticed that the laptop hadn't gone off as he closed it. A defect due to the short, no doubt. Intending to shut it down manually, he opened the clamshell. There were words. He scrolled down. It was all there, right up to here. He typed. These words appeared on the page. He erased them. As he did so, they reappeared. He did it faster, but the faster he worked, the faster they came back. Okay, this appeared to be insanity at work here. This could not be. He erased the chapter again. The process sort of made the words bounce, then they were back. He erased it again, then yet again and again, until erasure did nothing at all, not even a flicker. All right, this was crazy. This was not a possible thing. He closed 2012. Time to go nuclear. On his computer, he had a program called ZZZ, which would destroy any file completely. It used the same sophisticated techniques approved by the Defense Department for the destruction of classified files. He opened ZZZ and dragged the entire 2012 file into it. Neutron bomb, he muttered, setting ZZZ to DEFCON 12, its ultimate destruction level. So he'd write another novel, big deal. Later not, he'd come up with something. Even as he watched ZZZ work, the file came back. He destroyed it again. It came back again. There was no level in the program higher than DEFCON 12, but there was one other way to go about this. He went into the DOS prompt and typed erase star period star. By the time he was back in Windows, it had all returned. He stared at the screen. This was proof of something, because if you can't make the erase function on your computer work, things are crazy. Brooke, he called, from their kitchen. Yeah? Could you come up to my office for a second? It's important. Wiley, I've got a million balls in the air. Brooke, please. In a minute. He found himself shaking, feeling the clammy coldness of fever or fear, because this was proof, right here staring at him, that all these nightmares and all this craziness had something real about it. It was exactly as real as he had feared. He jumped up and got out of the office like the place was on fire. He ran downstairs and threw his arms around Brooke. He kissed her forehead, her lips, her neck. Hey, I'm cutting up a stew here, fella. Never leave me, for the love of God, never leave me. He took her in his arms, and this time he kissed her hard, pushing her head back, pulling her body to his until she was collapsed against him, her breasts compressed against his chest, their genitals pressing through their clothes. When he let her go, her eyes were soft with pleasure. We're gonna have a long night, I hope. I'm gonna break you in half, you gorgeous thing. Then all of his fear surfaced, and he held on to her as he might to a life preserver in the wild ocean. I love you with all my soul, he whispered, his voice hushed in his truth. Probably she didn't quite understand what had inspired this, but she didn't need to. The intensity and the honesty were there. She stroked his head, and her hand against his advancing baldness felt as soft as the wings of a butterfly. He remembered the yellow porch lights of his boyhood,
and the moths there, their fluttering the only sound in the quiet of a summer night. Thunder rumbled, long and low. It was accompanied by a distant flicker of lightning, and he reacted with a surge of terror so great that he all but pissed himself. He raced into the living room, cutting off lights as he went. The sky was alive with flickering. He went out onto the porch, looked up into roiling high canyons of madly flickering clouds, and then at his kids running around in the eerie light. "Kids, come inside, please." "Aw, Dad." "It's lightning. It's dangerous." They continued to play.
"What's going on?"
Brooke asked. "Look at the sky."
"Yeah, so what?"
"You don't understand."
"Honey, it's miles away. You can hardly even hear it. Let them play."
"No, please, for me, because I'm so scared for them, Brooke. I am scared for my kids, and you need to help me."
"I think Crutchfield needs to help you."
"Okay, look, if you would deign to come upstairs for just a few minutes, I can prove to you that something is wrong around here, very wrong." She followed him. "Okay, now, I erased Chapter 7 of my book just now, and it reappeared. Then I erased the entire book, and it reappeared."
"You erased your book?"
"Absolutely. From the DOS prompt. Absolute erasure."
"God damn it, we need that money. We need... I don't know what we need here exactly, but I do know that these people on the other side, they're having a hell of a bad time.
And if I can erase this and rewrite it, maybe things will get better for them, and maybe for us too. Because there is a nightmare over there, and it is about to invade us too." She sat down at his desk.
"Oh, this is nonsense. Here's your book right here."
"Erase it."
"I will not."
"Okay, then watch this." He moved in front of her, and she grabbed his wrist. Her grip was strong, shockingly so.
"You will not, Wiley Dale. You will finish this and turn it in, or you will lose me and your children."
"Excuse me?"
"How much self-indulgent bullcrap can one woman take? Answer me that, because I am personally at the end of my tether with you. I can't handle this anymore. How dare you bring me up here and terrorize me playing games like this? We could lose everything, end up on the street. I'm sick of being the wife of the rich writer who is actually a poor bastard."
"Never tell anybody I'm broke."
"Then write a book that sells and you won't be. Put food on the table, goddamn you."
She got up and stalked out. "Dinner in 10 minutes, she called over her shoulder. "There's obviously food on the table," he muttered, but very softly. Then he went back to his desk, put the Corona aside, and opened the laptop. He began to type. Outside, the electric sky flashed. He worked steadily. Thunder began rolling as the source of the lightning swept closer, rumbling across the gathering night. Outside, the kids, now wearing sheets, swooped in the dark. It was as if death echoed in the thunder, for he knew that this same storm, across the divide between the worlds, brought with it the body thieves. Downstairs, Brooke began singing, as she usually did after they'd fought.
"Listen to the mockingbird sweetly singing, singing over her grave."
She knew. That was why she was singing a death song like that. That was also why the kids were playing Ghost. They knew in their secret hearts that their counterparts in the other universe had lost their souls.
"Supper's ready," Brooke yelled. "And you might think about coming down in a reasonable time for once, Wiley."
He thought of Martin in his prison cell, looked in his mind's eye, and saw him standing there, just standing, in the steel and concrete chamber. He knew that Martin could hear his friends, most of whom he had known all his life, in the next room. What was left of the town crowded into that small space, arguing about whether or not to kill him. They didn't care about the 10 million bucks. What was that anyway, at this point? But they had this warning from the authorities, and they still trusted their authorities.
"You idiots!"
he yelled. He knows something. That's why General Sampson wants him dead. The man knows.
Shut up and get down here. Your supper's getting cold.
Yes'm.
Texas Max, the local contrabandista, had gotten in some fine absinthe recently, which Wiley had bought, of course, and put in the back of his desk drawer after giving it a taste. Hideous stuff, but it did pack a pop. He got it out now, unscrewed the bottle, and chug-a-lugged. Fuckaroo! He went down to his dinner and ate in silence.
What's that smell, Daddy?
What smell?
Ew, Daddy's been eating licorice.
Brooke eyed him, but said nothing. In hope of disguising the smell, he gobbled pearl onions. He'd left the damn absinthe on his desk, too. He needed to get that back out of sight. In the past, there had been serious fights over his various excursions into the world of drugs. After discovering that there was not a single official opium den left on Earth, he'd set one up in the garage. He'd needed to see what opium was actually like for a book. When she'd found him and Matt out there stupefied, and Matt still in his cop get-up, she'd hit the ceiling. And as far as his crack pipe was concerned, even he wasn't crazy enough to try the stuff, but he had the pipe. Again, research. Like the dominatrix. It had taken some real fast talking when that damn Amazon had burst in on them one night demanding cash for pictures. But it hadn't looked like him in the contraption, thank God. Lila hadn't fazed Brooke. "If you want to get into leather, I'm your girl," she'd said. "But be careful, because once I start, I ain't stopping." She was back in the kitchen starting in on his job, which was the washing up. Kelsey joined her, still in her ghost robe, and their voices as they worked together created in him a joy so gorgeous that he thought he might levitate. He loved this family of his so very, very much. "Let me do that," he said, getting up. He took the stew pot from her and set about scouring it. She was not a Teflon user. She preferred iron and copper, anything, in his opinion, that increased the workload of the cleanup crew. So be it, though. She was one master cook. She could turn 12 carrots and a few pounds of beef into manna, as she just had. As he worked, he did not see the face that appeared at the window so briefly. The dark mirrors of eyes, the terrible eyes. None of them saw it. Chapter 8. December 6th. In the Deep of a Man. General Al North woke up to find that his head had been forced back and something was being shoved down his throat. It was a struggle just to draw breath. Instinct made him try to scream, but he gagged against what tasted sour and cold and must be metal. His eyes focused on the only thing he could see, which was a white film of some sort. He looked at it, trying to understand what it might be. It undulated slightly, perhaps being moved by a draft. And then he realized that it was a white sheet, that his own bed sheet was drawn over his face. Every muscle in his body twisted and tightened until he thought they were going to knot and pop like rubber bands. His lungs bubbled. He began to feel air hunger, and then was lost in a hell of gagging as the thing in his throat was twisted round and round. It got dark. There was no warning, no flicker of lights. It simply got dark. Al couldn't tell if he'd been blinded or the lights had been turned out. Then he saw a small red glow. He smelled tobacco smoke.
"Who are you?"
he tried to ask around the thing in his throat. His voice was a pitiful, choked gabble. Something brushed against his naked body, first on his face and neck and chest, then his shoulders, his arms, legs, genitals. A soft tickling, like the fingers of a mischievous woman. Then came the most exquisite sensation, an extraordinary, profound relief.
The hard, pulsing thing was drawn out of his throat. He felt air roar in, heard gargling. Then there came a sound, high, shattered, which stopped when he snapped his mouth closed, determined not to shriek like that, not a general in the United States Air Force. In the thousand places on his body that the tickling was present, there began a stinging. This sensation deepened fast, and as it did, subtle fire seemed to race through his skin. He groaned, willing the raping fingers to quit, but they would not quit. Voices murmured in an unknown language, a strangely soft tongue with a twanging music in it, full of lisps and peculiar whistling sounds mixed with ugly gutturals. It was complex with nuance, trembling with emotion, not human. A face came into view, peering at him, waxy with makeup. The face was female, but the eyes, gold, oddly metallic, stared with a reptile's empty fury, implacable. He thought it must be a mask. Yes, plastic. Or no. It was pliant, it was alive, but once again there was a reptilian effect, a shimmering smoothness that suggested that it was composed not of skin, but scales, very delicate ones. The eyes began snapping back and forth like the weak eyes of an albino. They looked like actual metal, like gold teeth might look. They were sickening. As the figure moved in and out of view, black, curly hair bobbed prettily. It was a woman, he was sure, and she'd just had her hair done. He did not want to die like this, in ignorant agony, like some lab animal being dissected alive on behalf of an experiment that it could never hope to understand. He tried to speak, but nothing came out but puffs of air. Then he felt something against his head. Spikes. They seemed to drive into his skull. The golden eyes fluttered and darted. The voices pattered on, rapid fire. He felt, then, something entering his rectum, more as if it was crawling into him than being thrust in. She said something. Urathota. Said it again, louder, speaking to him.
I can't.
The thing was pushed back into his mouth, down his throat, and he could feel it in his stomach, could feel it meeting the thing that had been sent up his colon, and now there was a sizzling sound, and a taste like burnt bacon, and smoke came out of the sides of his mouth. It didn't hurt, but he thought they must be killing him, and he struggled, thrusting himself up, trying to somehow expel either of the things that were doing their work inside him. Laughter came, high, quick, unmistakable for what it was. And then there was something. Yes, plans. He saw plans. Now they came into clearer focus. Pages and pages of reports, of emails, of orders. I'm downloading, he thought. He was seeing every report he'd read over the years, every plan he'd examined, every specification he'd approved. He thought they were looking for something in his mind, but he could not follow the pattern of the search. He'd overseen a lot of construction in his career, most of it innocuous, but not all, and they were soon in his memories of work done at the Cheyenne Mountain facility, and that was very secret. Stifling heat was what woke him, a great wave of sweating misery, drawing him out of what felt like death itself, a sleep so deep that it had no door. What had just happened? He crouched in the humming silence, feeling the pressure of the air conditioning against his back. Then he stood up, went into the head, and stared at himself in the mirror. Hollow-eyed, haunted man. His mouth tasted of something toasted and sour, burnt vomit. He opened the medicine cabinet and found some mouthwash, swilled it and spit it. and watched in loathing as hundreds of writhing black threads went swarming down the drain. He spit again, a mass of them, ferociously alive, squirming and struggling, making a sound like spaghetti being poured from a pot. He cried out, and then saw that the sink was clean, and the mouthwash still in the cabinet. He was dreaming. That was what was going on here. He started to feel relief, but then noticed that his billet was thick with tobacco smoke, and he did not smoke. He loathed smoking. He sat down on the side of his bed. The smoke seemed real, but maybe it wasn't. Maybe he was still in the nightmare. Or maybe somebody nearby was smoking, and the odor was being carried into his room. It was possible, of course. In just the short time they'd been in occupation, it had become obvious that the place had been constructed out of cut corners. The smell was fading, and he was beginning to feel a little better. He tried to think back on what just happened, and see if there had been some pattern in what had been looked at in his mind. When he tried to inventory the flashes of memory, though, he found something odd. They really were not very important, just the debris of his years as a military executive. Of course, some of them were secret, such as the floor plan of the Cheyenne Mountain facility, but they were easily obtainable without revealing to a senior officer like him that they were of interest. What was odd was the curious feeling that it was something other than the information that was important. He looked down at his own hands, craggy now, once as soft as a surgeon's. He'd never flown in combat, but he'd read that great aces like Albert Ball and Bubi Hartman had such hands. Hands reveal people, he'd always thought that, and he wondered now why this thought was even passing through his mind. But as soon as he did ask himself the question, he knew. He almost cried out. Then he felt a gnarled agony in his gut and understood that his soul had not been stolen from him, but rather that it had been raped. And he knew that his loves and his secrets had been turned inside out, that his most private places had been seen, that what he was had been violated. It wasn't a nightmare. They'd been here, and they hadn't been looking at floor plans. They'd made a map of his naked soul. His lips twisted. He sucked breath, forced back the screams. This was violation at its deepest, its most profound, violation of the secrets of the sandbox and the playground and the blushing first love, of the sweaty experiments, the discovery of girls and the long descent of his wife and his losses, so precious to him, mocked and tossed aside by snake-faced monsters. He had been evaluated and measured by somebody so darkly evil that their most neutral touch was a corrosive horror. He thought, it's a negative civilization, a whole world ancient in its days that has become corruption. And it had work for him to do.